My intended outcome for this morning is not really to make sure that you get it, because it's pretty tough to get it in 3 hours, but I'm going to try to do my best to make sure that you understand my story, who I am and what I am, where I come from, why I find myself suddenly doing something of a spiritual nature as opposed to studying the art and science of taking human life, which is what I was raised to do by my father and he was raised to do by his father. Four generations of career military officers, and now one stands here and says to you, I'm going to talk to you about spiritual journeys and about discoveries of life beyond the physical and those kinds of things, and we'll get to that. I would like to talk only for a couple of hours and try to give you as much time as I can for questions and answers, because that's really where the magic begins to happen, I think. Also, I know that there are some of you that will need to go at noon and we'll take a break so that you can leave, but I have agreed to stay longer so that you can ask more questions if you would like to. That said, before we really get into the mix here, I just want to ask you to do one thing for me. Check your academic and your intellectual egos back at the door. Don't bring them in here and try to grind axes or present your agendas. This isn't your platform, okay? What this is a place where you need to listen with your heart and with your mind and try to become something other than what you were when you walked in the door. Try to transform by listening and understanding the purity, the truth, both the eagerness and the reverence of the truth of which we're getting ready to talk about. Understand that the reality that I'm going to talk to you about is part of the reality that you've all played a role in. Either passively or actively, you've all played a role in it. And some of the things that I talk about, some people take offense to because they don't like to think that it exists, that it's really there. They don't like to think that our government was involved in some of the things that it was involved in. But I will present that to you in its reality. And then we'll take it from there and talk about what the great spiritual awakenings are that have been born out of that, and those that have made the sacrifice to take it in that direction. And I ask you to try to understand purely about what I'm talking about. Listen with your heart and with your mind. And when we get to the questions and answers, you can ask the most difficult you choose, and I'll try to give you the most difficult answer that I can. All right? Now, send me some good energy up here, because I've been traveling all night. We're in the mix of teaching an advanced class in remote viewing down in Charleston, South Carolina. And I left there last night. And haven't slept yet because we've been flying all night. Stuart Newberg was an interesting airport to come flying into. Two missed approaches today, last night, as the ceiling dropped. So it was pretty scary. I was thinking, well, you know, maybe they might have a different way to be talking about this tomorrow if this airplane, you know, crumps into the trees. You know, they'll be thinking, just put the headset up here. Just, you know, let him speak. So, this is a bizarre tale that I'm getting ready to weave for you here. As I said to you, I was a third generation Army officer. My entire life was spent becoming an Army officer and being raised by my father to be the best in that profession that I could possibly be. And if you believe your efficiency reports, which most of us understand we shouldn't, but we try to, that said destined to wear stars and going to be the chief of staff of the Army one day, etc., etc. So I was very good at what I did. In 1987, I was commander of Bravo Company, first the 75th Ranger Battalion. Some of you may know what the Rangers are. They are the great white sharks of our Army. Their mission is to close with and destroy the enemy. And I worked in that particular operation, and I commanded for 2 years, and in 1987 I was selected, my company and I, to go to the Kingdom of Jordan to train Jordanian Rangers, and so I was there training Jordanian Rangers. And on one particular exercise, I had 24 machine guns in a support-by-fire position that were suppressing an objective while I moved with an assault element down to the long axis of the objective to attempt to take out bunkers. And when a signal went out for a shift fire, one Jordanian machine gun shifted the wrong direction and put 75 to 100 rounds of grazing fire 1 meter above the ground, traveling at 2,832 feet per second, swept through the ranks of 40 men. Not one soldier, not one of our Rangers was hit, except one, me. I was struck in the head by this machine gun bullet. It was a direct hit, not a ricochet. And it hit me in my Kevlar helmet, and if thank goodness for Kevlar, because had I not had Kevlar, I wouldn't be sitting here again. It would have gone in the front and out the back. But the Kevlar bullet deflected it and caught it. But it knocked me unconscious. Now, during the time that I was knocked unconscious is when a transformation began to occur in me. An angel or an apparition or a phantom or a ghost or a spirit or an entity or whatever you want to call it came to me during a vision, during this being knocked unconscious. A conduit was opened into another world for me. And this being that came to me said, amongst other things, probably the most poignant of what was said, was this: you have chosen the wrong path in life. You are to choose a new path. You are to choose a path of peace. You are to teach peace. Now, other things were said, but that was the most life-altering of anything that was said during that time. And when I came to on the desert floor, and I leapt up off the floor, and all my dirty-faced rangers that were sitting around me were staring at me, there were a lot of things I could have said, but I did not say to them, "You will not believe what just happened to me." Because you know what would have happened then, right? They would have very fast radio call back to the rear, and they would have put me on the first thing smoking back to the United States. So I followed the guidance of an old general officer, which was to be your own counsel, and I was my own counsel at that moment and said nothing to anyone, except I began to wrestle with what the meaning of that was. I was very happy doing what I was doing, and now something says to me, "You're supposed to be doing something else," and it began a split within me. And as the weeks and the months rolled by, eventually I left the Ranger Battalion, and then I was recruited into a special access program. Not the top secret clan of psychic spies, but into an organization in Washington, D.C., where I served in another function, in a clandestine covert military operation. But going through that into that special access program, I was required to go through an extensive battery of psychological evaluation and testing so that they could find out what my envelope was. And accelerating this part of the story very quickly for you, it was at that time that a recruiter, a lieutenant colonel psychologist who was detailed to this particular organization to keep his finger on the psychiatric pulse of all that was happening in this organization, identified me as a potential candidate for this other program. And when I confided in this psychologist about these experiences I was having, of these things being seen that I was seeing that no one else did, and things that I was hearing that no one else heard after this gunshot wound, this lieutenant colonel went through the process of recruiting me into a top secret clan of psychic spies called Remote Viewers, that operated in support of the United States government intelligence collection activities at Fort Meade, Maryland. Now, let me stop right there, because that's where I reported for work soon after this. But let's talk about where that all came from and how that got to that point, because we're not going to be able to talk in great deal today about the mechanics of remote viewing. We'll talk about the structure of coordinate remote viewing. We'll talk in brief about the mechanics of extended remote viewing, but it's not as though I can take a 35 to 70 hour class and squash it down into 15 minutes and make it understandable to you. That's always been the great difficulty. I can explain some of the physics of the metaphysics for you, and I can answer your questions, but we can't turn this into a remote viewing class, unfortunately. Circa 1973, the former Admiral Stansfield Turner, then the chairman or director of the Central Intelligence Agency, found out through various human intelligence sources that the Czechs, the Chinese, the Soviets, the Israelis, the Germans, and even the British were all heavily involved in various aspects of studying various aspects of the paranormal. And what they were doing this for was trying to find out if they could use various aspects of the paranormal for intelligence collection activities. Now, all of that spun off from various things, the Nazi occult bureau, things that the Russians took out of Berlin and took out of Nuremberg that they took and developed their programs. The British did the same thing, which was their counter program to the Nazi occult bureau. And all of this spun out of the late 30s, early 40s, and the 50s. So this had been around for a long time. Now, many of you are thinking to yourself at this point, it's been around for a lot longer than that. And of course it has. It has been around for millennia. But these were programs that were beginning only decades ago that were trying to unravel the mysticism of what we were talking about in a spiritual sense here. But of course they were attempting to try to use it in a way that would allow them to gather intelligence information on the real or perceived enemies of their countries. So this involvement then with Stansfield Turner turned around and said, if they're all doing it, why aren't we doing it? And of course the answer was, we don't know. So he said, well then we should find out about it. So at that time, they directed the SRI International, okay, Stanford Research Institute International, as a civilian contract for hire with a very large endowment of tens of millions of dollars, and took two laser physicists, Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff, who in my opinion were the early on heroes in all of this, because they were men that were hard scientists, physicists, who put their reputations on the line to explore this thing that says there is something more than the physical. You know, we all know that for all of our lives, we have all been told that there is not, or that if there is, that we are supposed to accept it on a basis of faith, and that goes contradictory to the very nature of who and what we are. You know, it is like being the early explorers, which is what we really are, as explorers. That's why you're here today, because you're explorers. 96% of the United States, of the population of the United States, believes in something more than the physical. 96% accept the reality, based on faith, that there is something more than the physical. You are here because you hope, you pray, you want, you wish, you desire to know that there is something more than the physical, right? Some of you believe that you do know that there is something more than the physical. But that's why all of that transpires. So these men were early on heroes, risking their reputations to say what the reason and rationalism of modern science, or to challenge the reason and rationalism of modern science, which says what? Like the old maps, you know, beyond this line lie dragons, right? And what they say, the reason and rationalism of science says, beyond here lie dragons, okay? Outside this, dragons dwell, okay? Stay here. Listen to what we tell you, okay? Listen to what we tell you and accept what we tell you and you will be safe. Dragons won't get you. So, SRI goes through a series of a testing and evaluation using tens of millions of our tax dollars, taking natural psychics that they brought in from all over the world and New York and other places, stood them on their heads, put them in metal boxes, sunk them in submarines, spun them around, put them in rooms with mirrors, did this, did that, did everything that you can classically call an examination from a scientific perspective of the paranormal. And they came up in 1978 with a protocol, a method, a structure that, in the words of Russell Targ, allowed us to take someone with the psychic ability of a bag of hammers and teach them to see distant in time and space. Yes, you got to stay with me now, okay? The psychic ability of a bag of hammers, which means you don't have to have some natural gift. You don't have to have natural conduits open into the unconscious. They can be developed. You came into this life with those conduits. You came into this life, as a Swedish pediatrician in class one day said, seeing perfectly. That's how you came here. You saw perfect. We've tried to explain the ability to learn to see with non-physical eyes and the coordinate remote viewing perspective as going through the development of physical eyes. That's how we tried to explain that. Trying to say that you begin by seeing nothing but dark swirling masses that later change into texture, later into contrast between light and dark, later into color, later into perspective, proportion, and so forth and so on, until you see perfectly like us, right? And the Swedish pediatrician said, no, we understand they see perfectly. That was his hand and arm signal, which I use so much now. They see perfectly. What do you mean they see perfectly? They see perfectly. No, not physically perfectly. They see, they feel, they understand, because the veil has not yet been closed behind them. Ah, now that began to make a little sense then. And so then what happens is, as they begin to develop their physical sight, we begin to teach them to see imperfectly again. We begin not to encourage the sight of perfectness, okay? Seeing things, feeling things, intuiting things, because that makes you odd in our culture. We began to squash it down until we could put them in a place where we made them see exactly as we wanted them to see. And they lost a remembrance of what they used to know before the veil was closed. Now, when this particular program was brought back again, their charge to the Central Intelligence Agency or by the Central Intelligence Agency was to say, we want you to evaluate this. Get up, Mark. You got to move the camera now. We want you to evaluate this. We want you to tell us, is it credible? Is it doable? Is it trainable? Can we identify the psychological profile on certain individuals to allow them to be capable of doing this? Is it a viable intelligence collection process? And can you explain to us how it works? Well, they came back with the protocol after 4 years of test and evaluation and said, yes, 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 but no, we can't tell you how it works. Well, that, of course, is when, what? All the skeptics jump on and say, aha, beyond here lie dragons, we told you that. You cannot explain to us in a verse of science how it works, so therefore it cannot possibly work, right? These are the same individuals who will go to church on Sunday and sit in the pews and pray to something that they cannot see. They are skeptics, okay? They are the same individuals who will read the Skeptical Inquirer by the light of the lamp that they turn on when they know fully well that there is not a physicist on the planet who can explain in anything other than theoretical terms how electricity travels down a wire. Yet they do not question it. They don't read by candlelight, do they? So they accept and embrace what is within their comfort zone, because the reason and rationalism of their science does not yet allow them to look out where you are looking right now and saying, beyond here may lie dragons, but I'm willing to sacrifice that to find out exactly what is out there, outside my skin. Targ and Putoff did that, and they are very brave men for having done that. Because at the end of 4 years of exploration in this particular genre, you know what all of their colleagues would have wanted them to do, don't you? Say, there's nothing to it. We spent $50 million in 4 years and there's nothing to it. But instead they came and said, it's there. It's really there. So that began in 1978 then, the process of our government using this and farming it out into various parts of the intelligence world. Now when they did that, the program I was under the Directorate of Technology and Science of the Defense Intelligence Agency down in Building Air Force Base. And that unit had a very sordid past and a lot of people trying to kill it because of its controversial nature, but it was there. It was under the absolute direction of a man by the name of Dr. Jack Verona, who was another physicist and the chief scientist at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Kind of makes you start to wonder, huh? Here's this exploration outside the body happening, and here are all of these scientists and physicists under our government that are bringing this all in and watching it and farming it and using it. For the next 20 some odd years, this particular program existed under many different code names: Sunstreak, Stargate, Grill Flame, Center Lane, etc., etc. The one that I was part of was not the only one. The intelligence community never puts all of its eggs in one basket, and they would never allow some rogue like me to step forward and say, here's a book about the unit, and so let's kill that particular unit. They keep it in different places so that if they have to collapse one, then they will collapse that one. Okay, so now you understand the history of the unit, where it came from, how it got there. It was not born in some back room by some starry-eyed New Age guru. Not that that's a bad thing, but that's not where it came from. It was born in a bed of science. And that's kind of why Greg said to you that this, you know, is not what you're normally hearing in this particular genre, in this crowd. There was a time when I used to sit here and face you and say, I am not of your tribe, you know, that's how I began this, because I sincerely felt at that juncture I was not. I was still very heavily attached to the world which I had come from. But I have spent so much of my life now talking about peace and talking about understanding that you are omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal beings, and letting you understand that you have lived before and that you will live again, and letting you understand that from a perspective of science, not from a perspective of me telling you that and asking you to accept it on a basis of faith. And that's really where this remote viewing thing comes in, is because it was designed as a scientific protocol. And though you come into it, what you will do when you finish learning it is simply this. You will no longer believe or hope or wish or want or pray that there is something more than the physical. You will absolutely know by irrefutable, undeniable evidence that you are more than the physical. because that is part of the process of learning to do that over and over and over again. And ask any of those who have been through the training. It is no longer a question of, I believe that I'm more than the physical. I believe I have lived before. They know. Now that's a powerful thing, you see, because believing is easy. Knowing is much harder. Knowing is based on experience in the physical and the non-physical worlds. That's what it is. And so if you really want to know that, then you have to do something that allows you to have irrefutable, undeniable evidence that you have the ability to transcend time and space. And if you have the ability to transcend time and space to see persons, places, or things remote in time and space, if that is there and presented to you, and you absolutely know at the individual level and at the collective level that you are capable of doing that, then how powerful do you become with that knowledge? Okay? It is magical transformation, psycho-spiritual transformation, that gives you an awareness, a complete understanding and awareness of your relationship to self, of your relationship to others within the human society, the global society, your relationship to the universe, your relationship to the Matrix. And the Matrix is something we were using long before Keanu Reeves made that movie. The Matrix refers to all life everywhere, transdimensional, omnidirectional, infinite in nature, all life. Now, when I was in this program, my transformation had only just begun with this apparition coming to me saying it was time to move to another life, to another path. What really began to happen was, in this organization, we began to see things differently, and a transformation began to occur within the individuals in the organization, which the government never counted on. You can take a group of people and you can train them to do something, and you can expect that their loyalties will continue to lie with, you know, the duty, the honor, and the country, and supporting the great lie. The great lie is that everything we do in the interest of the national security. So therefore, anything, any means is justifiable by the end, right? Okay? That's the great lie. That's why you cannot pass judgment on those who live the great lie, because in their hearts, what they're doing is a service to you and a service to the country, when that is not always true. But this transformation began to slowly creep up on us, because we began to realize our mortality and our immortality all at the same time, in a very real way, every day, going to work every day, transcending time and space. The Department of Defense definition of what we were taught to do was this: it is the learned ability, implying that each of you has this within you. Each of you does. It's not unique to me. You don't have to get shot in the head. Okay? You don't have to be a natural. You can learn to do this. The learned ability to transcend time and space, to view persons, places, or things remote in time and space, to gather and report intelligence information on the same. Now, take that outside the military context, apply what your personal mythology with that will be, with a spiritual meaning, a spiritual definition, apply a new origin to it, and think what you can do with it at that juncture. We still worked doing what we were doing, but our transformation began when we started being given targets that were asking us to look outside something other than a missile silo in the middle of Siberia. I had one occasion when I was in the unit. I had a very close friend by the name of Michael Foley. And Michael Foley was like a brother to me. And we served in Panama together. And I just remember, you know, Michael, when I would get on a helicopter after having been in the jungles forever on patrol, and this aircraft, this old Huey, would sit down on some grass-covered small landing zone, and I would jump on that thing, and here would be this guy turning around with his helmet on, looking back at me, and I must have smelled like a rug in the back of his craft, you know, and he would look back at me, and there was Michael's face, my brother, you know, hauling me back out again. And Michael went through some difficulty personally in his life and spiritually in his life, and he had an occasion where he was being deployed down into South America on a classified mission, and he called me up one night and said, "Dave, I need you to come over and watch the house, and I need you to take care of the dog and that kind of stuff." And I was in a company command at the moment, and I just didn't want to have anything to do with it, and I was not a good friend. I was not a good brother at that moment. And I just told him he needed to find somebody else to do it. I wasn't going to have time to be able to do that for him. So he quietly hung the phone up, and it just troubled me in that exchange. And some days later, I heard in the operations center that there was some hoopla going on about an aircraft going down, and instantly I just sensed that had to be, you know, that Michael was in trouble somewhere. The gist of this particular story was that this aircraft on a classified mission went down, and the last transmission in the aircraft was made by Michael Foley, a warrant officer pilot. He was there with a CW3, a chief warrant officer, the third level, Dave Souter, and a non-commissioned officer in the back monitoring the radio monitoring equipment. And Michael's last transmission was, "We have a problem, wait." And then the aircraft dropped into the jungle, triple canopy jungle in the mountains of Ecuador, and was never seen or heard from again. Literally just swallowed up, which is what happens down there. An aircraft will go in and it'll just disappear. 8 years later, I now am showing up for work in this remote viewing unit, this top secret clan of psychic spies. And as I'm going through this training and I am beginning to see more perfectly, as skeptical as any of you could possibly be, I had no background to support this, no lexicon to support it, and all of a sudden I'm being taught how to transcend time and space, to see things, persons, places, or things. So I have a meeting with the director of this particular organization, of which there are only 8 of us trained as viewers. And I'm still in my training process, and I meet with Fern Gavin, and Fern says, "Any needs? Anything you'd like to do?" "Well, yes," I say. "I would like to try to put this to an experiment. I would like to know if we could use this to go find Michael Foley." And he says, with a weird grin on his face, he gets up and walks over to a file safe, and when he goes to the file safe, he comes back with a stack of blue folders, all stamped top secret, and he sits them down and says, "Take a look at these." And I go and look at this, and what has happened is there are some 30-odd sessions that were done. A session means a remote viewing endeavor by one individual, a session, which lasts about 90 minutes to 3 hours in duration, transcending time and space to view persons and events. Okay, and in this particular case, looking and watching this helicopter crash take place. And each viewer that was doing this was describing in sequence how the aircraft went down, watching it collapse into the jungle, describing one by one each of the pilots as they died, and Michael died last. So as I am reading this, of course, the tears are flowing because this was my brother, and I'm reading an account of my brother now, how long it took for him to perish there alone in the jungle, watching the NCO die first, Dave Souter die second, and then Michael laying there with all of these thoughts going through his mind, because the remote viewers have the ability to step in behind the physical being that they are remote viewing and sense the emotional, aesthetic, and intangible qualities that are going on beneath the surfaces of the skin in that individual. And Mel Riley, who was one of the other remote viewers and who was my mentor and my trainer, steps up. He is an old master sergeant, guzzling coffee that could take rust off metal, smoking cigarettes one right after the other, but an extremely spiritual man, looks down at me and says, "Would you like to say goodbye?" Because he worked those targets. His viewer number was there, because we were all referred to by numbers, not names. "Of course," I said. So I was taken over then and given an opportunity to go through the cool-down process. The cool-down process is where you are trained to go into an altered state of consciousness, to move from the beta wave state, where most of us are now, some of us are in alpha, but to move from the beta wave state down into alpha, okay, and then to descend from alpha down into theta, and operate as an extended remote viewer in theta, and operate as a coordinate remote viewer in alpha, because there's a different process in alpha. There's a kinesthetic activity called detecting and decoding that has to take place, a dance from the unconscious matrix to the conscious matrix, back to the unconscious, etc., etc. More on that later if you ask. And so I go over and begin this process, and I take the coordinates which are given to us, which are randomly assigned numbers representative of the concept of the target in the matrix of the collective unconscious. Don't try to think too much past that, it just hurts your head. And nobody really understands how or what it means anyway, we just know that we can establish an address based on a thought form or a concept of a target somewhere in the matrix of all creation. And that you can follow what is called a signal line, a hypothesized train of signals, leading from that concept into that particular target, be it distant in time, be it distant in space, be it past time, future, or present, okay? And more on that, and Dirac's delta function and those kinds of things later if we get into that. I found myself standing then at the edge of a jungle. Now, part of this is called analytical overlay, which means my conscious mind was at work packaging data that I was bringing in from the unconscious. So part of the picture I was creating, that's called analytical overlay. And you learn in the remote viewing process how to deal with that. You recognize that it will be present. None of it is pure viewing, okay? When you close your eyes and go through the process of descending into an altered state of consciousness and creating visuals about something, it is not pure viewing. It is not pure recall. Much of it and how it is packaged and how it is presented to you is based on your conscious evaluation. It is based on your experience Rolodex. And it takes data coming from the unconscious and it begins to package and pigeonhole and construct and put in boxes and label. At the speed of thought, it does it. And it presents it to you and it says, this is what it was. So you learn to deal with that. You learn to sort out what is real and what is not real, okay? What is usable and what is not usable. So as that process is rolling, and you have to understand that about yourself, back on that theme, okay? You have to accept the fact that your conscious mind plays a role in what happens in that. That your conscious mind evaluates what the unconscious mind presents it. It does it. And you will never stop that from happening, no matter how hard you try. That would imply that you were trying to excise your imagination from yourself. Okay? And that's impossible to do. You cannot stop imagining. Imagine stopping imagining. Okay? It couldn't happen, right? So it's something you then have to learn a protocol that allows you to sort it and sift it all out. If you're seeking truth as a path, not an objective, but if you're seeking truth about something in the past, then you must understand that you have to pursue it both in the eagerness and the reverence of it. You cannot do what most of us do in our genre, which is to pursue the eagerness of it. What I see is what is real. Not necessarily. It does not mean that it didn't happen. It just means that how you're interpreting it is just like looking at a die when you throw it, you know? You see a different side every time, a different perspective. And those are the kinds of things you learn. The reality of seeing and decoding the data that comes to you from the unconscious. See, that unconscious aspect of yourself is that omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent aspect of yourself. The conscious mind is that part which puts you here, balances checkbooks, and allows you to function and move through this physical three-dimensional existence that we find ourselves in right now. Being able to tap into the unconscious, that omnipresent, omniscient, eternal aspect of yourself, seeing across the spectrum of time and space, seeing where you have been, what you have done, and how you have done it, is you have to have a protocol that allows you to do that. And you must accept the fact that if you what you bring back into consciousness can be skewed, okay, can be altered, can be changed by your conscious mind. That doesn't mean don't do it. It just means accept the reality of what the limitations are. Michael, I know you were waiting for me to get back there again. Michael steps out of the mist. And Michael explains to me what has happened to him. And Michael allows me to say goodbye to him. And Michael assures me that what I am seeing is real, and that Michael lives on, and that what I am seeing at this particular point is what in Dirac's delta function would be seen as an imprint, a burned energy imprint. All things are energy, and energy is all things. And what I'm experiencing there in the past is not some apparitional form of Michael that will be locked into this jungle scene for time and all eternity, but an imprint that is there, okay? That is what I'm able to go back and experience, and it will stay there. But Michael has gone on. And Michael will move on to another existence. And Michael assures me of that while I'm standing there. And in one great final coup de grace for me spiritually, Michael says, and tell Sharon it's okay to do what she's asking to do. Now, I had not at that point talked to Sharon Foley, Michael's wife, for 7 years. We talked to Sharon a year after the accident happened, and then Sharon went her separate way. And Sharon waited it all out, because if you have a soldier and you're married to and he disappears in the jungle somewhere, it's 7 years before they will finally declare him dead. For 7 years she stayed married to him, and for 7 years she hoped and prayed that some new evidence would come and that they might find him suffering from amnesia, wandering in some jungle hamlet down there, but they never did. So 7 years later they pronounced him dead. And when they pronounced him dead, then Sharon was thinking about remarrying, but I didn't know that. And my wife at the time, Debbie, did not know that either. And here Michael says to me, tell her it's okay. So of course we call Sharon up, right? And tell Sharon, you will not believe what has just happened. You know, I was easy at saying that at that point. You will not believe what has just happened. And I am at this point already going through my psycho-spiritual transformation to the point where I said, yes, I signed a secrecy oath, which said I will not divulge information about what I'm involved in. But when you start to understand what it means to see perfectly again, when the veil is becoming transparent behind you again, when you're able to understand the eternal nature of yourself anymore, what does it mean putting your signature on a piece of paper that says, I will not tell the world about what I'm experiencing here because I believe that this can benefit all of humankind? How can I rationalize and justify this being sequestered away as an intelligence collection tool or as a weapon of war when it should be something that's brought out for all humanity to experience, that they can know that they are eternal and omnipotent and omniscient? And you may think that you are right now. You may firmly be rooted in that belief structure that you are. And that's a good thing. But we spend a lot of time going to hospices all around the world because we want to talk and interview to people that are there. And you know what goes on in those hospices? You know what goes on there. But do you know what happens with people that are there? When you talk to them, when they finally get to the place where, first of all their personal affairs are in order, that's the big concern while they're there. They go there to die, so while they're there, when all their personal affairs are in order, when they know that their family is going to be taken care of, their children, their husband or their wife, when they know all of that's done, the next thing is you ask them the question, what are you concerned about when this happens? Nothing, they'll say. God will be there for me. Jesus, or whomever they happen to believe in, will be there for me. I'm going to Valhalla, I'm going to paradise, I'm going to wherever I'm going. They all are firmly rooted in that belief structure. But as the days close, to that one final breath, as the days close, when you finally get there, if you stay there, and you're there as a friend asking the question, when you finally can get them to let go of the belief structure, the ego that's there, not to try to destroy it, but to say, what are you really thinking now? What are you really feeling right now? Right now, what are you really feeling? Literally, virtually, almost 100% of them will say, I'm just wondering if it's all real. I'm just wondering if I've been a fool all these days. I'm just really wondering if somebody's going to meet me on the other side when I close my eyes finally. And that's the reality of that. They may tell you anything as you stand by their bedside. I'm okay. God, come and take me. Okay? But what's really going on in their heart is it real? Now, you can tell them all you want that it's real. They could have gone to whatever type of belief structure that they went to all the days of their lives, been a tithe payer, been, you know, a Sunday school teacher, whatever it happens to be, whatever your belief structure happens to be, and all paths, all of those paths are good paths. I'm not attempting to impugn them or try to demean them at all, not at all. We teach and we support all of the paths and the significance and importance of those paths. But if you could take those individuals, and we have, and put them through a series of protocols and exercises that show them irrefutably, undeniably, that they are more than the physical, and that they have lived before and that they will live again. And to watch the spirit, the countenance, the transformation blossom in them, That is a magnificent thing. And each of you has that ability to show them how to do that. Each of you do. To allow them then to pass over, to cross over into the next existence with an absolute assurity, an absolute assurance, an absolute knowledge that someone will be there and that they will move on again. In remote viewing, what has been found throughout the years of our study and our examination of this, because in the remote viewing classes, you are given an opportunity to do something that is called an open search inward. Now, the open search inward is based on this. If you have been given the opportunity to look at something on the surface of a planet, distant in time and space, let's say, and we bring you back and we have known quantifiable, measurable attributes that pertain to that particular target, is what we call them, target, okay? And you produce a certain amount of data using the protocols of coordinate or extended remote viewing, and then we evaluate your data. You do it yourself, you know, and we do it with you. And as a collective whole, we all look at that data, and the great magic that happens there is you get to see, like, maybe I'm a 5% solution on this particular session, but she was an 85% solution, and he was a 65 and 70 and 30 and 40, et cetera, et cetera. So you begin to see the significance of the collective endeavor in that regard. When we do this in this open search inward, after you've done these calibration targets where you have known quantifiable measurable attributes about what you've looked at, and you can establish a numerical score for your ability to see something distant in time and space, then we will send you at some point, and you will never know when it's going to happen, on your first open search inward. And the first open search inward is designed to do this, to take you somewhere along the timeline of your soul. The signal line will take you to some place of significance for you. And using the same credible discipline of extracting and decoding data from the unconscious mind, of categorizing the analytical overlays, et cetera, moving through the two kinesthetic activities of this process, you will begin to unfold your next life, your past life, and the past life, and the past life, and the past life. And in all the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of remote viewing sessions that have been done in my presence, 9,000 students so far in 3.5 years, 9,000, I've never had anybody come to me and say, well, I came to the end of the tape. You know? Because you have lived eternally. And we don't have a projector here, but if we could show this to you, we present, you know, entry and exit points along a timeline for you, not in linear formation, but in four categories, four ladders, if you will. And we show an entry into, based on our research, an entry into the physical dimension, wherever that may have been, and then an exit back into the matrix, a re-entry into another existence, and an exit back into the matrix, and a re-entry, etc. And we've shown it based on the sketches provided by remote viewers, and it looks like a ladder. And so we know that it goes infinitely vertically and infinitely this direction, and we know that the ladder reaches around and ties itself. Now, this, I hope you're following me visually with this, but that then means that you have, if you went straight rung to rung, you would go around, but what happens is it's a helix and it twists. And so what happens is you're actually climbing or descending in this ladder. Now, we had this all splayed out one time, and we were giving a presentation, a couple of Harvard medical researchers and a dream researcher are looking at it, and they said, you know, one raises their hand and said, well, that looks remarkably like DNA, you know, the way that's broken down there, because we had these gatherings, which means that, essentially this, we all find ourselves gathered together here in this physical three-dimensional existence where we are now. Well, when we pass from this existence, what we will find is that we will not all be together. We will be in different positions, in different places. Not that one is an established hierarchy, that one's better than the other, but that they are an eternal progression to go to the next, to the next, to the next existence. And what the research from remote viewing has found is simply this. We did not always wear these skins, okay? And you will not always wear this skin again. God only knows what you'll have, you know, the next place and where you will have in the other place. And that, I know, goes counter to what many of the traditional Eastern philosophies regarding reincarnation talk about. And again, it is, be open, okay, to what are belief structures for you. Be open to another approach to this, and be open to the exploration and the possibility of that, because thousands have made that discovery, that they have lived before in other forms, and that they are living again, will live again in other forms. But when these Harvard medical researchers looked at this and said, two of them together sitting in shorts and sandals, you know, in a tropical environment where we were, said, that looks like DNA. The response from one of the assistant instructors was to say, yeah, but the DNA only has two helix. And if you're anything into biochemistry, you understand that it's two helix. And any biochemistry chemist will stand up and fight you to the death on the fact that DNA, if you know anything about it, cannot have anything more than a double helix, right? Any biochemists in here? They're like, no, we'll wait till he makes his point, and then we'll raise our hand. We'll surface later. But then one of the researchers says, but, you know, are you familiar with phantom DNA? Are you familiar with phantom DNA? Anybody? There has been discovery made that there is a third helix in DNA. Oops. And there is research and more information available that they believe that they will find somewhere within the next 48 months, a fourth helix in DNA. Now, that changes the whole imprint of what we believe we are and where we came from and everything else. That changes it all. Now, most that are involved in that, when you talk to the normal mainstream reason and rationalism of science, will vehemently oppose that. But you must take that into consideration and understand that if you talk to most physicists today, unless they are involved in new physics or quantum physics, most of them will still believe that their science is based on a series of absolutes. And any new physicist will tell you that that's not the way it is at all, that it is all based on a series of approximations, that it's approximate rules, and that it is changing every day, the laws of physics, constantly changing every day. Now, that's being open to the possibility that what you think you know is not necessarily all that there is to know. And that is really what allows us then to go to the edge of the map, right? To that place where the line was drawn that says, beyond here lie dragons. That's really the magic. But there are those among us, bless them, you know, that never would have crossed that line on the map, who would have stepped back and said, it is flat, it is absolute. Do not go there. You will be consumed. You will fall off the edge into eternal whatever. Okay? 5 years ago, there was no edge to the known universe. Now they're mapping it, saying, hey, we think it looks kind of like this, and there's an edge here. Think about what that means. If there's an edge to it, then what's it in? And then what's that in? You know? And then what's that in? And so forth and so on. So the science, the reason and rationalism of science is changing every minute, every second of every day. And what's happening is this split between science and spirituality is beginning to do this again. Okay? It's starting to come together. That's a cool thing. That's a really cool thing. But it must come together in a guided way. Global consciousness must raise. We must understand, we must know that we are eternal, omnipotent, omniscient beings. We must know that we have a responsibility here. We must know that, not believe it, wish it, or want it. That's weakness, okay? That's weakness. You must know it. You must involve yourselves in it. You must experience it and know it, because then when you do, the frequency with which you will vibrate this planet will be incomprehensible. And you will change our warring ways, and you will bring science and spirit together in a way that will be guided and directed and assisted, because if you do not, it will run the risk. Look around you now. Science and spirit on one plane is gathering together. Again, it's beginning to reach out and touch and lace itself together. If it is not guided and directed, what's going to happen to it? What's the largest industry on the planet? The industry of death. It is a $1.3 trillion industry and rising. In the century we just left, 185 million innocent men, women, and children perished at the hands of war and war makers. That did not include soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. They had their own death toll. 185 million mothers who never will be. great doctors who never will be, great poets, great artists, okay, who never will be, great writers who never will be. The cure for cancer may have perished in the last century, okay? So, what does all of this mean, and what do you do when you wrap it all up? You say simply this. I can stand before you and say that I don't believe that I've lived before. I can stand before you and say that I know that I have lived before. I have a protocol that allows me to see it, to experience it, to be part of it, to understand what is my own evaluation of that, my own perception of that, my own interpretation of that, and a protocol that allows me to put into place what I understand is good, usable, real information about where I have been and what I have done. And what has that done for me? It's obviously changed my life, right? I spent 18 years of my life studying the art and science of taking human life, as I said to you earlier. 18 years of my life. Until suddenly this ability was given to me, and this experience of seeing and saying and having closure with Michael Foley was given to me. And my calling and election at that juncture was made clear because of the experience of what I was doing. My calling and election was made clear to teach this, to talk about this, to tell you how powerful you are, to tell you how magnificent you are, to tell you that when you understand those things, that you will have the power to change the outcome of human destiny. You can literally alter the course of human destiny. You do not need to accept it on the path that it is currently on. Science and spirit are coming together, as we said, but something's wrong. Something's amiss. Something is not pulling in the right direction. Spirit is weakening. It is not intensifying. If it were intensifying to the level that we wanted it to intensify, then there would be a sympathetic resonance there. The industry of death would be turning around in a new direction, and it's not. It's only becoming more precise. It's only being able to kill on a greater scale with more precision, as if it can. And the desire to use weapons of war is increasing. It's not decreasing. It's not going away. It continues to increase exponentially. And it's a frightening thing. You are great explorers. You are great seekers. You are here because you want to know. So know. Know that you are eternal. Know that you are powerful. Do whatever it takes, whatever path you have to follow that empowers you with the knowledge that you are those things, not the belief. The knowledge, and then do what you can do to change the outcome of human destiny. Okay? Now, I'm going to turn it over to questions, because now you know where I am, where I'm coming from, and what I'm doing. And every question you ask me, don't think the lecture is over, because those that know me and have heard me before, you'll ask me a question and I'll go off on a tangent with it, and it'll get us where we need to be.
So since I've been remote viewing, the way that I look at myself, I think, is a lot more realistically and with truth and honesty and authenticity.
I was introduced to remote viewing not quite a month ago, and it would be difficult for me to pick any 30 days in my life that had a greater impact.
The thing that is remarkable and extraordinary about remote viewing is you begin to get a sense, a true knowing, that we are all one. That we are completely all one and connected in some of the most profound ways ever. And there is no way that you can ever look at your neighbor in the same way, or another country or another person, once you know that you're all one.
So remote viewing has really changed my perspective on learning and being able to be open to new ways of thinking or new ideas.
And since I began remote viewing, it's had a profound effect on my relationship to the world, in that I now look at what I can contribute to the world rather than what I can contribute to myself.
When I first took the CRV class, I remember driving home on the freeway that day, and it was the worst day of traffic I've ever seen, and I was like this. Go on, cut me off, it's all right. I was looking at people like there was some type of connection there, if you could understand that.
Yes, remote viewing is about, targets and that skill is definitely one that I know is there and it works. And it's also a lot more than that, which is why I haven't really talked about it that much. It's really, what do those targets mean? What is out there that I can learn on a personal level that I then have a responsibility to make sure that I can share with everyone that comes in my path? And not hold back that knowledge and not sort of be selfish with that knowledge, but actually put it to really good use. And I think there's so much out there that wants us to do that, that's helping us and that's on our side. And remote viewing's really made me aware of that. It really has.
Intrusion, yeah.
Everybody's got that? Everybody heard the question? The answer to the question is yes. In coordinate remote viewing, I can't take a drink right now because I got to talk, but if I take a drink, I am always destroying the Omega microphones. You know, one year I took a drink and dipped the mic in the hot coffee. And the next year, I did something else where I drank water and poured it in the microphone, so I'll just stay away from it. In coordinate remote viewing, the need to try to shield yourself in some way from some unwanted intrusion is not a requirement, because you're only dealing in an alpha wave state. In an alpha wave state, you are still consciously aware of what's going around you, what is going on around you. You are dealing in the kinesthetic activity of detecting and decoding in the unconscious. In the unconscious, you are detecting data using the protocols taught in coordinate remote viewing, and then you are decoding the data using the protocols taught into the structure of the coordinate remote viewing session. So this dance is going on back and forth constantly, and because the dance is going on back and forth constantly, you really have no time where you are completely open, bare, and naked to what is out there beyond the physical. Okay? So if it has to have an opening, okay? And it's energy, and it has to have an opening. And you don't give it that opening. You're moving back and forth in the dance, okay? And then afterwards, you are doing a session summary, and then you are grounding again, okay? And before you begin the process again. In core extended remote viewing, which is an advanced form of the phenomenon, in extended remote viewing, you are in target contact for an extended period of time, out to about 90 minutes to 3 hours. In that process, you are taught several mechanisms that allow you to use energy. Energy is all things, and all things are energy, okay? Use energy to reflect other energies, and that is taught to you. And there are people that do it every day when they get up in the morning or before they get up and at night before they go to sleep. And there are people that push it out to put it around their home and protect themselves or protect their families and those kinds of things. So it's all there. You're taught how to do it, and it is possible, and you can use it. Energy opposes energy. You can do it that way. It is not a blend, okay? One can overpower the other. One can reflect the other. One can cause the other to sympathetically resonate, okay? It's all works in the physics of the metaphysics in that respect, okay? But one question. If somebody else has another question, if somebody else has a question, jump on it. Yes. I don't want to be rude. I want to give everybody an opportunity.
When you talked about the open remote viewing that you had your students do, and that they would go back in previous lives, but that those previous lives were not necessarily with a human skin, but in other forms. Could you be more specific about those other forms?
Well, if I do, then I'm going to sound more like a sci-fi guy to you. It'd be like an explanation of X-Files here. But it's just the great reality that's come to the students is, And I've had a whole lot of psychotherapists and past life regressionists and engineers and physicists and doctors. And I mean, some of our student base comes from science you wouldn't even believe. The director, the commander of the Royal Norwegian Naval Academy, you know, the vice chairman of Bofors, and then a whole host of other people in metaphysical disciplines and those kinds of things. So we have this great, you know, wide spectrum of people who come in who, you know, want this because of the science of it as well as the spiritual aspect of it. But the students, the great surprise to them, it was not a surprise to me, but a great surprise to them has been this unraveling of existences that were not in human form. But yet they see where they start trying to take the experience of being in a not human form, in another realm, in another dimension, in another world, in another civilization, existing in that way, and where they start to take, the conscious mind starts to look at that, and it looks at, based on what you've read, what you've watched on television, the movies you've seen, et cetera, everything you know in your experience Rolodex, okay? And it starts pulling those things out, and it starts trying to put human form on it. And you learn to separate those things very gradually at first and then in a more exaggerated manner later. And it becomes a more fulfilling endeavor for them than to, and they understand more clearly then, that it hasn't always been just here. It doesn't mean it can't just, you know, that it can't happen here several times, but it has not always been just here, okay? You have not always been on this little blue planet, in this little tiny solar system, in this little tiny galaxy, in this universe that we now know we have an edge to, that means that there must be something that contains this universe, and if there is something that contains this one, then what contains the one out that side that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, meaning infinite numbers of possibilities, omnidirectionally, where you have lived, been, served, done, whatever you have done. And your recollection of those things, very real, and very precise, have a tendency to be overlaid by conscious evaluation. But how and what the students describe are as varied as the tongues in the students, okay? But it is a magnificent thing to watch unfold for them. Critical to them doing that, the reason for doing it is not only having this awakening that comes to them, but it is for them to understand that those existences have constructed what they are now, okay? That they are the culmination of all of those things. But that there is a great deal of attachment to those things until you can learn to see them and embrace them. Embrace them. I didn't say fix them. Embrace them. We always have this desire, we gotta go back and patch that up and fix it, you know? We have to do something with it. And the training is, that's not the requirement. You're not going to fix it. You're not going to patch it. You're not going to do something with it. Just embrace it. Accept it. Understand it. See it. Then let it go. Then turn to a life of possibility, understanding that you are the culmination of all that you have ever been, and that when you leave this existence, you will go on and go on and go on and go on. And there's a sense of freedom, a sense of release, a sense of freshness in them being able to do that. And that training allows them to do that.
It's been 10 plus years now that you've been doing this, with the information, now teaching it. Are you noticing or seeing any change in the way you're teaching or learning the techniques for remote viewing? Is there anything that's enhancing as more and more of this is being learned by more and more people?
That's a good question. The answer is yes. We, you know, years and years ago, I was teaching this with a handful of acetates, you know, and a boombox, you know. And today we take an entire production. I mean, we bring in a giant trailer now filled with stuff because there's so much gear that is involved in the process of teaching it that we bring to facilitate the experience of the students. And that involves, you know, video feedback of your targets, and it involves, you know, different methods of bringing you into an altered state of consciousness, and different things for you to practice opening up, and that kind of stuff. So the presentation is much more state of the art now than it ever was in the past. Now, that doesn't mean that it could not be taught with a handful of acetates and a boombox again, you know? It could be. And the boombox is used to play the cool down CD, which takes you into the altered state of consciousness, okay, which is what we present to you in lieu of anything else that you might have available. Because remember, we teach to a broad spectrum of humanity, and they are not all meditators. And some people walk in and have never once closed their eyes and tried to see what was there in the darkness of their unconscious mind. So we provide that for them. The rate at which students are learning is perfect into Sheldrake's concepts of, you know, the morphic resonance and those kinds of things, because you are learning in 3 days what took us 18 months to be capable of doing. Remote viewers in now 3 to 6 to 7 days are far greater remote viewers than any of us who ever went through the protocols years ago. Why? Because of the resonance, the frequency, the energy that is being present. You are all drinking from that pool of wisdom that was provided there by all of those who have come before you, and the involvement of this ritual of engaging in this. And so you learn exponentially faster, and the next class comes and the next class comes. And so what's happening is what used to be considered extremely advanced concepts in this are now all coming up to, you know, you're stepping into a coordinate remote viewing class and you're doing things that 4 years ago or 3 years ago, master class advanced phase four students were just engaging in. And now what's happening is they're engaging in techniques that are more advanced and more advanced. And the objective in all of this is to use this quantifiable, measurable protocol, evidence protocol, to be able to go to the edge of human knowledge and look beyond into the darkness and to see what is out there for yet more for us to learn. And just a final aside to that particular question is that one of the things we are learning is that we are quickly catching up to what we carried out of the unit in terms of our knowledge, meaning we are getting to the point where the students are going to be the teachers and the teachers are going to be the students again. That transformation is beginning to occur. The people that I am training and teaching are very quickly grasping the concepts to the point they are ready to spring beyond, and many of them have, which means that it is going to be only a very short time from now where I'm going to be the person learning from those I have trained, which is really the way it's supposed to be, isn't it? And I'm okay and comfortable with that. I always tell them in class, don't get any big ideas. You know, it's not going to happen for a while, but it's going to happen, and I know it, and I can feel it. And so we have developed a group that is called the Explorers Group, which is to look beyond the edge of knowledge, where we think we know about the levels of being able to see into the matrix that we have identified of where we are going next. And there is a concept that some of you may be familiar with called the return to the eternal return. And in talking about the destiny of souls and living lives before, one of the things that has been very interesting but yet not yet fully understood in the exploration of this phenomenon through remote viewing was this: that we believe now, based on what we have stumbled upon in open search outward, shotgun blasts into the matrix, the kinds of targets that viewers have found and that we have established as places of learning, have slowly become known to us as cosmological breadcrumbs that we have left for ourselves in an effort to find our way back to where we came, from where we came. And that is a very bizarre yet a wonderful experience to see each of these advanced groups coming to closure with that, and understanding that each of these things are placed there for us, oddly, we believe, we don't know, but we believe, to teach us something that will allow us to progress to the next level. And then we will learn and allow us to progress to the next level, etc. Finding our way back to something in the return to the eternal return. Okay? Next question. Yes. Just fight for the mic. No, don't fight for the mic. Just calmly, peacefully, humbly come up to the mic and ask me the question.
In your book, there's a couple points I had questions about. One was, I guess you had been given points and you landed in the ocean, but you didn't know it was the ocean.
Yeah.
And afterwards, Mel said to you that there was water on the floor. And then there was a point when Kathleen was in the desert and was rushed to the hospital because she was dehydrated. And yet when the part of you that is viewing, you said that part can go through buildings and go through people. So I don't understand.
Okay, I can answer that for you. That what you're describing is a phenomenon in remote viewing called bilocation. And people often get confused with our physical three-dimensional interpretation of that, meaning, oh, does that mean that you're really there, that your physical body is projecting itself there? And that's not what that means. It is defined as this: as the remote viewer increases target contact, meaning you are, the aperture into the target is opening wider and wider, okay? Meaning the signal data coming, the energy from the target and your presence, your projection of consciousness or energy into the target are beginning to merge more clearly. It's a perfect example of this experience Rolodex again. Your body then begins to manifest the physiological indicators of what is taking place in the site. So your body physiologically begins to manifest signs of what is taking place there. If it is a very hot, dry place, then your body, based on its experience Rolodex again, begins to manifest the physiological indicators that would fit an environment of hot and dry. Your mouth gets dry, your skin temperature raises slightly. It's not like it shoots up 30 degrees, but your skin temperature rises. If you're excited or something's happening in the target area that's exciting, your heart will race, okay? Blood pressure can increase, it can drop, heart can slow down. All of those standard physiological indicators of what take place in the conscious world happen there as well. Now, in the book, when there's this water that is thrown up on the table, there are a lot of people who will turn around and go, that's ridiculous. What is he trying to tell us or expect us to believe, that because he was remote viewing a Soviet Pomorek class air cushion vehicle that he's, you know, throwing up, he's aspirated water and throwing it up on the table? No, and I'm sorry that that's not clear in the book. What that meant in the original manuscript of the book was to explain, and it went through the explanation process. I was a military diver in my training in underwater operations, and one of the things that they do, if you go to military dive school, underwater operations school, what they do is they try to drown you, and they do. They don't want a carcass there, but they have medical staff on deck ready to revive you. What they want you to do is see how, they want you to understand and burn a mental imprint into your brain that says, with that last gulp of air, I can go this far before it all shuts down. They want you to experience that because that builds a comfort level in you, all right? Because now you know that I don't need to panic yet because I still have maybe two more fin kicks to plant this mine or charge or whatever it might be before I expire. Because it's really a cool thing, you know? It's like Looney Tunes, and it just all closes down, and when it all closes down, and it's all dark, and you have passed out, then what happens? You inhale through just the diaphragm expanding, you inhale a lung full of water, and there's no oxygen, we don't have gills, and it's all over at that point. That's why people tell you that drowning is a very pleasant way to go. Not in my book, it isn't. And I don't like ships at all, or anything like that, or submarines, or any of those kinds of things. So, nor is being shot, so I haven't figured out, if I had a choice, which it would be. So when you do that then, now my brain has done what? It has built an experience reference for that, right? And when you aspirate water, those of you in the medical field know, what do the alveoli of your lungs do? They begin to secrete fluid, right? To protect themselves from the insult of the water coming into the alveoli. They secrete a fluid. And it was that fluid, as I began to experience the pressure, the temperature, the difficulty in breathing, and the difficulty in moving at that depth of looking and being in the water, as I was increasing target contact and awareness, what happened was my brain started saying, I remember this, I remember what that feels like, and so it began secreting fluid over a period of time to protect itself. Now here's another example of that, and that's what got spit up. And here's another example. Anybody in here been a frostbite victim? If you've been a real frostbite victim, and you have, okay, then what happens is, if everybody in this room, if we sat here and started dropping the temperature in this room, because these individuals that have been frostbitten and have had tissue damaged or destroyed by cold, their brain has remembered that. And as the temperature starts dropping in this room, while the rest of us are putting on sweaters and maybe thinking about putting on a coat, they are starting to experience the indicators that are telling them danger, danger, Will Robinson, okay? Your temperature is dropping again, and they will start to manifest the signs of frostbite many, many degrees before any of the rest of us in here. If you have ever been a heat casualty, suffered from heat stroke or heat exhaustion, that's why in the military, if you have, they actually tag you and mark you because you have to be watched when the temperature starts rising. In this population of this room right now, if the temperature was raised slowly, those who had experienced that before, their brain calling upon that imprint again, start sending out the warning indicators that say, you are going to get sick again, you are going to hurt yourself, you're going to damage yourself again, you're going to pass out again, etc. So they experience it first. Their body manifests the physiological signs. That is the same process that happens in a bilocation. So when you hear a remote viewer talking about experiencing physiological what takes place in the site, that is the scientific explanation for that, okay? About why that happens.
I had the question, and I thought you answered the question, and I still have the question.
Okay.
I have not read your book or books.
Damn.
But the question is this. Therefore, I'm coming from a very, you may have said this somewhere else. You received this gift, I'll call it a gift, and did you ever look beyond that to say, where did this gift come from? Why was it given to me?
Oh, yeah.
And also, you talk about the crumbs. I guess that's where I thought my answer was, that you don't know, you're not going to take the step ahead to be presumptuous and say what it is, but you're looking at the evidence and you're going towards it. Is that what I should understand?
Yeah, I think so. In terms of, I mean, that's what I said to you when I said I know my calling and election has been made sure, meaning I know what I'm supposed to be doing in this existence. That's very clear to me right now. It is very clear to me. And so the gift I know was a gift for sure. It has been a latent ability in all of us, and it was a latent ability within me. And all that has happened is the gift was, here is the opening, here is what the protocol is, and here is now what you're supposed to do with it. You're supposed to teach it. And so that is not for me to tell you. That is for you to find out, okay? The question is, where does the gift come from? You see, we all want that, don't we? Morehouse, throw up the menu. Fast food, spirituality. It comes from, okay? That's for you to find out. And you know why it is for you to find out? Because if I tell you, then it will be either become a belief structure for you or it will not. The great disappointment of the Matrix is this. Here we are. We come into this existence. We are birthed into this physical three-dimensional world. And there are a series of filters that are established for us. Most of you that have studied this know this. Some of them are around 3 to 5 years of age, 10 to 12, and like 19 to 23 years of age. There are filters that are established for us. There's all sorts of other ones laced in there, but there are three main ones that are right there. And here's what happens as we stand in the herd. Someone steps outside of the herd, colored blue, okay, walks over and looks into the matrix, peers back into outside of the unconsciousness of consciousness, all right, peers outside the unconsciousness of consciousness and looks into the matrix and sees 50 pieces of an infinite number of pieces of reality and understanding, okay, and then comes back and says, or they say over here, I see what I see. They come back over here now and they say to you, here's what I see. And then a group of you steps over here and comes behind me and says, we believe what you see, okay? Then somebody else over here in red comes over outside the unconsciousness of consciousness and looks into the matrix. I see what I see. I got 62 pieces. He only had 50. You come back, I have 62 pieces. Here is what I see. Bunch of you come behind the lady in red, we believe what she sees, okay? Then someone back here in green comes over, I see what I see. I have 18 pieces, but there are better 18 pieces than the 50 and the 62, okay? They come back, here's what I see. Everyone else joins with them. They're right. Those 18 pieces are better than the other 50 and the other 62. Then what happens? She looks at me and says, he has more people than me. Let us mass an army and kill him and all of his people, and then we can get more of the others because the blue will not be there now, and we can take what remnants of blue there are and put them over here in red, right? And that is how that works until you come to the understanding that Everything you believe up to this point in time, and this is a hard thing to swallow, but everything you believe up to this point in time has been based upon your acceptance of someone else's interpretation, what they have written, what they have said, what they believe. You have accepted it. I believe it. Now, if you want to know truth in its eagerness and its reverence, truth is the aristocracy of spirituality. It has two things, eagerness and reverence. We pursue the eagerness of truth all the time. Somebody says something, this is what I see, we say, that's true. I believe that is true, I pursue that. The reverence of that says, where did it come from, as the question was asked? What does it mean? Why is this person giving it to me? Etc., etc. So I will always say to you, if you want to know if there is a God, if you want to know if you have lived before, if you want to know that, then go beyond the structure of belief. Go beyond someone else telling you that. Go to a place using whatever it is, whatever path you choose to go. Go to a place that begins and shows you irrefutably, undeniably that you are. And then make your own exploration inward and outward to find truth for yourself and accept your definition of the truth, devoid of someone else's interpretation, filter, perspective, or idea about what the truth ought to be. And you can do that. Okay?
I have a lot of questions, but I'll try and
limit. You only get one.
I know. I don't have any doubts about what you're saying. I mean, I've been in India where they levitate and all that stuff. But my question at this point is, if you reincarnate, and I'm not saying I know you do, but if you reincarnate from animals to people, different colors, from black to white, different countries,
go beyond that to different planets, to different dimensions,
exactly.
To different, okay?
Exactly. At that point, I don't have a doubt, but what does concern me is, where does it stop? In other words, you reincarnate to pay karma. If you're good, then maybe you get a better life.
But you don't, but remember now, wait a minute. Time out. You just said something. It was based on a belief structure, reincarnate to pay karma. Now, I'm really into the karma thing. I know that that works, okay? I know that that works. But that's not all you're in it for.
But do you reincarnate over and over and over to become illuminated, to become a master, and then watch down on the people that commit?
That's a really cool thing. Let's go to the metaphor.
You know, where does it end? And then the second thing, and most important, I guess, to everybody at this point is, like, if I take your course and I develop a mental development, how do I guarantee that I can take this to another lifetime so that when I go to another lifetime, I can avoid a lot of...
We give you a certificate of training that you can use anywhere. Just present it, okay? That's the best question I've ever had. Okay. So you exceeded my RAM, and I lost the first question, but I wanted to answer the first question. The other one was so choice. See, I did not encode that question, so I forgot it. I did not. It was what again? No, you guys all missed it. It was much better than that. I didn't. What was it? Master looking down. See why differences are so unique to us? Was that the question? Master looking down and difference. Ask the question again, the first one. I'll bet you don't remember it, do you? Okay, ask it. Ask it again. Just the first one, not the second one.
Okay, my first question is, if you reincarnate and reincarnate over and over again, where does it end? In other words, at the end of the line of many reincarnates, do I become illuminated and a master? Or
what's
the purpose of...
Stop. Okay, otherwise I'll forget it again. Where does it all end? Well, I told you already that nobody has come to me and said, I saw the finish line, okay? Where I'm gonna break the tape and then it's all over with, right? And then somebody goes, take a lounge chair and watch the rest of the finishers, right? You are on an eternal path towards wisdom, okay? We exist in a realm of belief structure until we experience in the physical and the non-physical, which then gives us knowledge. And as we gain knowledge, then we pursue understanding to take us into a realm of wisdom, okay? There's that old Zen saying, you know what that one is, right? That when a man gains knowledge, he becomes a sage. And when the sage gains understanding, he becomes an ordinary man again, right? So you are on an eternal quest for wisdom. There is no finish line, not that I've seen. And if it is an eternal quest for wisdom based on how we understand it, is you will never stop living, never stop learning, never stop experiencing, never stop gaining in wisdom, love, and understanding, and compassion, and experiencing all else that is out there. And what we must come to grips with here now is that we cannot keep thinking, although it is our nature to do it, that all of what is to be experienced out there fits within the realm of our spectrum of awareness right now. And I know most of you don't believe that, or don't know that, or don't accept just that. There is love out there that goes beyond our explanation of love. There is compassion, there is hatred, there is evil, there is goodness, there is light, there is darkness. It goes beyond anything that we have an ability to explain. If we could go on a scale from 1 to 10, it stops at 10, and then we have no more language or understanding of what we can experience out there, and then it goes beyond, but it's there. So don't ever start thinking or wishing or wanting for the finish to be there, because it will not be there. Now, there was another point I wanted to make, but I'm getting long on this answer. So it will not end for you. Eternal means eternal. Okay? It means eternal. I have never, ever seen it end. Well, that kind of goes to the metaphor of the mountain then, you know, which path is the best path? Because, in the metaphor of the mountain, there's that foothills mechanism that most of us adhere to, which is, I run to this path, and on this path it says, follow this path to the summit, because at the summit here lies enlightenment, right? And empowerment, enlightenment, empowerment, eternal, it's there, you'll get it, you'll know it all when you get there. And so here is that path. But then I walk a little bit further around the mountain, and I see another path, and that path says, no, don't take that path, take this path, because this path is paved, okay? No stubbing of toes here, this is all paved. And then you walk over to the next path, and it says, no, not that path, it's paved, but it doesn't have any steps or stairs. When it gets really steep, you can slide backwards, because it rolls under your feet, so take this path, because it has steps. You go to the next one, and it says, we have the best, we have an escalator. Okay, so we're powered, and we will power you to the place of empowerment. And you'll come to another one, and it'll say, no, take this one, because we have an elevator, direct, straight, vertical, no, no sideways stuff for us, straight up. And the idea is that one would think, what? If you could get to the top, then that would be the perfect place to decide which path was the right path, right? Okay? Because if you were on the top, you could look down and see which one was the straight shot to the top. And then you could say, okay, now I will teach what the straight shot to the top is. Correct? Yeah, logically, right? So then what happens is this. When you get to the summit, what do you find? Another summit. And when you get to the top of that summit, what do you find? Another summit. And another summit. And another summit. And another summit. Okay? On an eternal path towards wisdom. You have lived eternally before, you are eternal now, and you will live again. Okay? Next question. How do you take my certificate? Graduation certificate. We've worked it out. We have a physicist that's one of our students. We have a physicist along those lines. A physicist by the name of Kurt, who's was once a metallurgist for Bofors, a weapons lab. And Kurt now, through his understanding of remote viewing and what it has opened him to again, now speaks of metal in terms of the consciousness of metal and the unconsciousness of metal and the spirit of metal and those kinds of things. You can imagine what kind of a pariah he became around the coffee pot in his office when he started talking about those kinds of things, right? But Kurt now has developed a mechanism that has two opposing rams with about a 9-inch throw, and these two opposing rams strike metal so hard that it knocks it, in Kurt's words, unconscious, which means that it becomes something other than what it was, which means it becomes fluid. And for about 2 to 3 microseconds, it is fluid, which means then it can be poured or it can drop into a forge, into a die, right? Which means it can be cold forged, because then in 3 microseconds, it shakes it off and gains consciousness again, you know? So people in class have always come up and said, yeah, well, what are the moral implications of smacking metal so hard that you knock its spirit unconscious, you know? And Kurt has said, I asked the metal and it said, it's okay. Okay? So we have asked, and you can take the certificate with you. You want to really hear a really cool story about my dad, though? My father was the son of a 20-year career Army officer. My grandfather fought in World War I, my father fought in World War II, and in Korea. In Korea, my father was a maintenance warrant officer, and a tank that was under his purview threw a track and was in a depression, and the North Koreans were lobbing mortar shells at this tank. And they were going long and going short, which is called bracketing, and they were eventually going to cut the distance down to where they got right into the depression where this tank was, because see, when it went long, then the explosions were, they were protected by being in the depression. But if they got on target and did a little fire for effect right there in a depression, well, then they could kill the tank and kill the people that were in the tank or around the tank trying to repair it. So my father, also being a man who's crossed that line many times between bravery and stupidity, got in his quarter-ton vehicle with his driver and rushed forward to this tank, which was not behind enemy lines, but was there and needed to help these guys put this track on. And my father was helping to put the track on when a mortar shell landed within about 10 meters of the tank and exploded and blew my father under the tank, wounded my father's driver, and killed 2 crew members on the tank that were up above where the blast caught them and the shrapnel caught them and killed them. Now, that was not a story I ever heard until 1994, when I tendered my resignation to Major General Mike Steele for the good of the service and ended 18 years of service to the United States government and 3 generations of service. Now 4, my son is a military policeman. Some example I was, huh? I'm standing there with my resignation and my attorney and my mom and my dad, you know, my parents are very small and my father's Italian and my mother is German, and they're standing there and my father starts crying, and I've never seen my father weep, never. He has never wept. My father was the meanest man on the planet. And I mean it, the meanest man on the planet, and he's now weeping. And he stood by me through all of this encounter with the government and attempting to tell this story, and my father is weeping, and my mom says, this snappy little thing, you know, 5 feet 2 inches tall, you know, little gray-headed thing, looks up to my dad and elbows him and says, tell him, Verge, you know, tell him, like that. So my father wipes away the tears and he recounts this story that I just shared with you. And so what happened when you were blown under the tank? And he said, I lost consciousness. And an angel came to me and said, you will one day have a son that will teach peace. Now, so all the days of my life and all the days of my brother's life, my father now, because what was that for a man of that age in that era? Way outside the comfort zone, right? So he spent all the days of his life trying to prove the vision that he had wrong, which is why he was the meanest bastard on the planet. Because what he was making sure was that he created 2 little army officers that would go on to do, because that would have made sure that what happened to him was just, you know, the concussion of the shell, and that it was not something of truth that came to him outside the physical world, which he accepted as his one and only reality. Do you understand that? And so now all of a sudden, it has come full circle for him. Now all of a sudden, the son that he tried to build the warrior in has now, his life is unfolding in a different direction. And he sees it and he knows it and he knows what happened to him 40 some years earlier or 30 some odd years earlier was in fact truth. 40 some odd years was truth. And so my father is my greatest fan at this point. And he comes to seminars and does other things to tell that story and to be there with people. Because he now understands that he is eternal. He went through two wars not knowing that. He went through two wars hoping that, wishing it, wanting it, then struggled against it. And now he knows it. So you don't think he walks around with a grin on his face nowadays? And my mother as well? So, I don't share that story with many.
How are your students who are using CRB helping personal transformation and global transformation?
Well, there is a very passive role that you play, just in moving in the, you know, the synergistic effect, the vortices effect of playing a collective role in that learning and elevating that consciousness. All of you, by being here, you are elevating consciousness to a certain level, right? You're contributing in a positive way to all of that. So they play that in a very positive way, but a very small way. Then others of them, because they are constantly challenged to redefine what their personal mythology will be, means what are you going to do with this? In the Explorers group, which is the advanced group, that some in the class here have been through that, in this lecture have been through that, will meet once a year. By design, they will meet once a year. Part of what they will do when they get there to that class is they will give an accounting to the rest of their peers of what they have done. What have I done this year, okay? To decrease fear, to decrease hatred, to increase love, to increase compassion, to increase this, to take away from that and diminish that. What have I done in my life to make a difference? I have an accountability, I have a responsibility, and I will share that with my peers, what I have done, okay? And that will be that process, to allow them to further define their mythology. There are other people that just come out of the class and as the awakening occurs, change their life, transform their life altogether. I mean, some get out of bad relationships and get into good ones, and some quit jobs and go to other jobs, and some explode out of everything for a while and kind of hang there, deciding where I will go next, understanding that the truth of the matrix will show me what I'm supposed to do, and then I'll go do that. Some have decided they will work with the youth of this planet because the millennial generation is still without a cause, although they know that it is there for them. Ask them. They all know that they are significant in the global societal evolutionary process. They know they are significant. They, our children's children, most of us in here of that age, our children's children will be those who bring us back out of whatever ash there is from the destructive phase of global societal evolution. That destructive phase will occur. It may be that long or it may be that long. It depends on us. We're setting the stage for that, but they will be, the millennial generation will bring us from that, okay? They will bring us out of it. We have a tremendous responsibility to secure a place for them and their ability to see perfectly, to know they are eternal, to know the power and the magnificence that they carry with them into this existence. If we don't, we do them the greatest disservice that we could have ever done to them, which is to leave them lost in the unconsciousness of consciousness, to find their way in darkness, in the darkness of the physical three-dimensional world, with no knowledge of the eternal nature of themselves, other than something we feed to them from a spoon and from a book that says, believe it because I do. Give them the power that is theirs to know that they are eternal, to know it. And you must start by knowing it yourself. Okay? Now, I have gone to 12 noon, so as I promised, I am going to release you and we'll take a 15-minute break. And those who want, before you go though, and those that want to come back, I'll stay here and entertain more questions for maybe another hour. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you.